For those of you who may be new to the village as of yesterday, my name is Tom Lee. I'm a Lutheran campus pastor at the University of Montana. And this week we've been doing a series of studies of Isaiah chapters 40 through 55 under the heading of the Gospel for Exiles. Tomorrow will be the last in the series. I know that got the sense that a good number of people are leaving today to maybe give you some indication of what we'll be doing tomorrow. I'm going to conclude tomorrow by looking at the so-called servant songs of 2nd Isaiah, passages in chapters 42, 49, 50, and then that famous fourth servant song in chapters 52, 53, the suffering servant. He was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities, that famous passage that we all know. My point tomorrow will be that this servant figure, who in those pieces of poetry is anonymous, but there are other indications in Isaiah, and the traditional interpretation has been of this, that the servant is to be seen as Israel itself, the people. This reconstituted nation of Israel coming out of exile, returning to Zion, returning to Jerusalem, is the servant of the Lord. And that servant is a suffering servant people. They serve on behalf of others. They witness to others. And that witness is one of suffering. It involves pain. And in that passage, certainly we see a prefigurement in how the prophet describes this vision of what his people will be. We see prefigured in that certainly the Christ as the one who suffers on behalf of all the nations. But the point I'm going to end with tomorrow is that in a sense, at long last, in terms of this material from this part of Isaiah and the kinds of implications it has for us as the people of God today, that the point on which I'm going to end is that we too are having experienced that new exodus, that new creation, because of our baptism into Christ. We are called on to be that suffering servant people of God, just as the prophet called his people to be, with that new exodus, that new beginning in their life and in their experience. So in that light, if those of you who can't be here tomorrow want to roll around in chapters 42, 49, 50, and 52, 53 of Isaiah, you might want to do it with from that kind of perspective. One brief announcement that immediately after our gathering here this morning, I know most of you will probably want to go have coffee. In case some of you don't want to have coffee or want to run and get a quick cup and come back here and stand around the perimeter, some of the kids from Narnia are coming over, and I'm going to show a sampling of some of the slides I showed last week in this time slot of one of the excavations I was on in years past. This one happens to be the one from summer of 1981 at a place called Bab Edra along the Dead Sea in Jordan. So it's to give the kids some feeling for biblical archaeology, and if any of you are interested in eavesdropping on that, you're more than welcome to do that. That'll be during the coffee break time, between our hour and 10:45 hour here. So far, in our work with this prophet this week, it's sort of been in the abstract. We've dealt with the poetry, the imagery. We've dealt with how the prophet is talking about this coming time of freedom, of salvation, liberation, new creation for his people. But it's been indefinite. When is this going to happen? Even the language used has sort of a fairy tale quality to it. Something off in the indefinite future, this transformation of the wilderness, this this time when mountains will be laid low and valleys lifted up and the wilderness will become the Garden of Eden. It sounds unreal. But the prophet doesn't leave us with thinking that these things are off in the indefinite future sometime for some new age. He sees these things as happening in the experience of his people immediately. It's right around the corner. Do you not see it? The time is at hand. This new exodus is something that will be historical. It will be within the present experience of his people. It's only weeks, months, a couple of years at the most is the kind of feeling we get from reading this prophet. And so the key for this, the historical agent, the historical reference point for these things to happen is bound up with the ascendancy of Cyrus, the king of Persia. So for a couple of moments, I'd simply like to review a bit of history for you. That I realize is not the most exciting thing, but I think it's important. Just as an aside or as a footnote, one thing to remember about the Hebrew prophets is that they are persons of the history of their people. They read the signs of the times. They're concerned with with not the indefinite future down the line someplace, not some never land, not some kind of long ago and far away kind of understanding of history, but they're concerned with the present history, the present experience of their people. What's happening? What will soon happen to the people of Israel, the people of Judah? And our prophet is no different than that. So something about Cyrus. Cyrus became king in the year 559 BC. Now, just to stop for a moment, the time of the exile is about that 50-year span from 587 to 538 BC. So sort of in the middle of that period, Cyrus becomes king of a very small vassal state called Anshan, A-N-S-H-A-N, which, interestingly enough, Anshan is, that name was still a part of the throne name of the Shah of Iran, overthrown just a few years ago. Part of his throne name, his full name, there was still a remembrance of this vassal kingdom out of which Cyrus came. Small vassal kingdom in what would now be the southwestern part of Iran. It was a vassal of the Median kingdom, the Medes, which was an empire between Babylon, between Mesopotamia and Iran, right along where the present frontier or border would be between Iran and Iraq. Well, the Medes controlled this vassal kingdom as well as a number of other smaller Persian vassal states. In 559, Cyrus succeeds his father as king of Anshan. 9 years later, in 550, he is able to put together a coalition of other Persian states and overthrow the Medes, overthrow the empire of which ruled them. In 547, just 3 years later, Cyrus, in terms of amassing his forces and becoming a king of all these Persian tribes and states, is clear in the west. He's in Asia Minor, present-day Turkey. He defeats the kingdom of Lydia with its capital Sardis. And all of a sudden, Persian control extends from what we think of as Persia or Iran, across what had been Assyria, northern Mesopotamia, into Asia Minor, Turkey. And all of a sudden, Egypt and Babylon and other states have to sit up and take notice. This guy's for real. Something's going on that now frightens us, terrifies us. Cyrus was able to extend his power from Turkey in the west, capturing the Greek cities of Western Asia Minor, Western Turkey, clear to the east, to the borders of India, to the northeast, up into Samarkand in present-day Soviet Union, almost to the border of China, an amazing empire carved out, established within the span of not all that many years. In the year 540, Cyrus invades Mesopotamia, lower Mesopotamia, where Babylon is. By this time, the Babylonians are demoralized because of the power of Cyrus. Nabonidus, the king of Babylon, is half mad, evidently. He's off in the desert at an oasis trying to rule from there. He's not even in Babylon. In 539, 1 year later, 1 year after invading Mesopotamia, Cyrus enters Babylon itself, the capital city, and takes it without firing a shot, so to speak. He's welcome. The gates are thrown open for Cyrus and for his armies. Even the priesthood of Marduk, the great god of Babylon, the priesthood welcomes Cyrus as the new protector of the god of Babylon, the god of Marduk. It's that person and his rise to power and his extending of empire and his march now towards Babylon that becomes the historical focus for the expectations that this prophet sketches out for us. To go a little bit beyond, to continue the story beyond the time of our prophet, just to add a couple of things. After Cyrus invades Babylon in 539, 1 year later in 538, he delivers a decree or an edict, formal proclamation, permitting the Jews to return home and authorizing the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. The temple that had been destroyed by the Babylonians, he authorizes that it be rebuilt. And so this passage here, Ezra chapter 1, is one place where we get a summary of that edict of Cyrus about the rebuilding of the temple and about the permission for the Jews to return home. I think that edict ought to be read against the background of what we were talking about on Tuesday in terms of the kind of understanding in the ancient East about the relationship between the god and the king and the building of a temple. That all those old Near Eastern stories about the about creation, about the ordering of chaos, end with the building of a temple to the god who has done this. As Baal defeats the hostile forces of sea and brings about creation in the Canaanite story, that story ends with the building of a temple or a palace for Baal. Same thing in Mesopotamia, as the god Marduk brings about the ordering of chaos, establishes the world. That story ends with the building of a palace, a temple for Marduk. And in that context, we've got the authorization to rebuild the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. The agent of this is remarkable. It's not a king of Israel, king of Judah, but it's a king of a foreign country. But the authorization would have been interpreted in Jewish circles as a statement of the power of Yahweh, that Yahweh has now defeated the forces of chaos, that imprisoned his people. He's brought about a new creation of his people, and that's rightfully concluded with the rebuilding of the temple to Yahweh. The rebuilding is something that comes after the time of our prophet, but it's something that did take place following the edict of Cyrus. Evidently, some work was started on the temple. It was suspended for a while because of the opposition of neighbors. The people of who were the predecessors of, or the ancestors of those people we know as the Samaritans, opposed the building of the temple. They did not want to see the temple rebuilt and placed some barriers. But later on, a few years later, that the under the exhortation of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, in 520 work was started again, and the temple was rebuilt and rededicated in 515 BC. So that's just some historical information about that period in which we meet our prophet and we meet this person to whom our prophet points as the agent of God's act of salvation, his act of new creation. So I'd like us to turn to this primary text here, chapter 44, starting at verse 24 through 45:13, and to spend a little time just looking at that. This whole passage, I think, hangs together in terms of being a unit, having its own integrity, from the 24th verse of 44 through the 13th verse of 45. It begins with creation language. Thus says the Lord, your Redeemer, who formed you from the womb. I am the Lord who made all things, who stretched out the heavens, who spread out the earth, who frustrates the omens of liars, who turns wise men back, who confirms the word of his servant. Just as an aside here, the word servant here is the word we're going to deal with tomorrow in terms of the servant figure. In this particular setting, verse 26, servant is paralleled with messenger. The servant here is a prophetic kind of figure of some kind. So we've got this series of participles in Hebrew. Yahweh, who does these things, who creates all these things, is the one who now says of Jerusalem, she shall be inhabited, and of the cities of Judah, they shall be built. The God who brings all things into being now wills the rebuilding, the restoration of his city. Verse 27, this kind of construction continues of the series of participles, who says to the deep, be dry, I will dry up your rivers. Given the context here, deep, it's not the word deep that we talked about on Tuesday. That deep that is sort of almost transparently an allusion to the deep as the forces of chaos in some of that mythic material. It's a different word here, but I guess I'd say that that may be implied here. The Yahweh who says to the deep, be dry, Yahweh who rules the deep, that stands for these cosmic forces of chaos and of destruction, who has power over those. The Yahweh who can do all these things, who can create, is then the one, verse 28, who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. The creator of all things, the one with all this power, now says of this historical figure, he is my shepherd. When we hear the word shepherd, I suppose we have these kind of the solitary pastoral kind of image of the lone shepherd out grazing his flock. Basque sheepherders in southern Idaho or northern Nevada, or eastern Oregon, something like that. Something that we may miss is the significance of the word shepherd in the ancient Near East and in the Hebrew Bible as a title of kings. Kings are described of as shepherds. Some passages that come to mind, Jeremiah 23, first eight verses of Jeremiah 23, Ezekiel chapter 24, where these are oracles of judgment upon the shepherds of Israel, in other words, the kings of Israel, who have not lived up to their responsibility as shepherds of the people of Israel. So in the Jeremiah 23 passage, there's a judgment upon the shepherds who have not fulfilled their royal responsibilities, and then the prophecy of the coming Davidic, the king, who will be the true shepherd of his people. Shepherd is also a title of kings outside of Israel. So to call Cyrus a shepherd is not remarkable, but there is the note of the unusual here in that it's Cyrus is called my shepherd, the shepherd of Yahweh, the shepherd who does Yahweh's will. Who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and he shall fulfill all my purpose. I'd like to stop here for a moment and just focus on that word purpose. I take that word purpose to be one of those words that the prophet has intentionally used to stitch together these 16 chapters. In chapter 46, verse 10, which is in one of these passages, in chapter 48, verse 14, which is in another of these passages, these are passages that also refer to Cyrus. I might add that the last one I've listed here, I put a question mark by it. Some people would take that as a passage referring to Cyrus. I don't. I'm inclined not to, and for reasons we'll talk about tomorrow. But in chapter 46 and chapter 48, there are references to the purpose of Yahweh being tied to Cyrus. That Cyrus will accomplish my purpose. And that word purpose we pick up again at the very end of the book, chapter 55, verse 11. So shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth, it shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose, and prosper in the thing for which I sent it. Now the idea of Yahweh's purpose, his intention, it's the same word in Hebrew, comes up here at the very close of this section, when the prophet is drawing his material to a close. And now it's tied to the word. The word that was introduced way back in chapter 40 at the call of the prophet. In that those familiar lines, chapter 40, verse 5, all flesh shall see together that the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. And then over against the futility, over against the destruction, there is that response in verse 8 of chapter 40. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. The word, Hebrew word here for word is davar. Powerful word, the word that brings creation into being. God speaks in Genesis 1 and it happens. Psalm 33, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made. That all-powerful word goes forth and accomplishes its purpose. And that word, in accomplishing its purpose, is vested in these events that this Cyrus is bringing about. As he comes and captures Babylon, takes it without a shot, as he delivers the decree to allow the people of Israel to return home, as he delivers the decree that the palace, the temple, for Yahweh, the God of the, who created heavens and earth, that temple can be rebuilt. So Cyrus, fulfilling this purpose, the purpose for which that word has gone forth, the word that will not return empty, that will not return void. He shall fulfill my purpose, saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple, your foundation shall be laid. This is what Cyrus will do. In parallel to verse 28 comes the first verse of chapter 45. Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped, to subdue nations, to open doors, and so on. But I want us to play with for a while is that word that the Revised Standard Version translates as anointed. Cyrus is the anointed of Yahweh. The word in Hebrew is that. Now you may not recognize that, but you'll recognize it if I simply translate it this way, transliterate it this way. Messiah. Mashiach. Messiah. Cyrus is the Messiah of Yahweh. Put yourself in the shoes of Jews in exile in Babylon. Some of those Jews had given up on any kind of restoration. They'd made their accommodation. We're in Babylon to stay, folks. Let's make the most of it. Didn't Jeremiah write us this letter? One we talked about from Jeremiah 29, you know. Put down your roots, raise families, pray for the welfare of the city that is in which you now live. You know, some of the Jews had given up. You know, we're in Babylon to stay. Other Jews said, well, did not Yahweh make a promise to David? That covenant with David. 2 Samuel chapter 7. Covenant with David rehearsed in some of the Psalms. That David and his line would be kings in Israel forever. And so there were some who said, well, there are still heirs, pretenders to the Davidic throne in our midst. There are still people who have Davidic credentials who stand in that bloodline. We can still have a king. We can still have a Messiah. Messiah was a word in Hebrew that was exclusively used of kings who had Davidic credentials. It's only those who stood in that bloodline who could be called Messiah. And so maybe Yahweh will have his Messiah, but it will come from those descendants of the last kings of Judah who are here in exile in Babylon with us. And in that context, what does this prophet say but of Cyrus? Cyrus is the Messiah of Yahweh. This is the only verse in the Hebrew Bible where the word Messiah is used of somebody who does not have Davidic credentials. He's a foreigner. He's a Zoroastrian. He's a pagan. You know, just, you know, put yourselves in the shoes of that audience. It's dumbfounding. It blows one's mind, so to speak, to use the more recent jargon. Incredible, absolutely incredible, that this prophet has Yahweh say that Cyrus is the anointed one, the Messiah of Yahweh. Alongside this, put those passages that recur time and time again in this. Book about Yahweh doing new things. Chapter 43, for example. Chapter 43:18-19. Remember not the former things, nor consider the things of old. Behold, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? Phraseology that we meet again in this prophet. This prophet proclaims a Yahweh who does new and remarkable things. Things that have not been done before. Remarkable things, such as calling Cyrus his anointed one, his Messiah, who will accomplish the salvation of his people. When we talk about the God who does remarkable things, new things, unexpected things, you and I read this about calling Cyrus the Messiah. We too think of remarkable and unprecedented things that God has done in a virgin's womb, in a cattle shed, and on a Roman cross. Chapter 45 continues with this announcement of Cyrus as to what he will do. He'll subdue nations. He will open doors, or doors will be opened before him. I will give you the treasures of darkness and the hoards of secret places. Why? Why is Cyrus doing these things? Or why does God anoint Cyrus to do these things? So that you may know that it is I, Yahweh, the God of Israel, who call you by name. The prophet anticipates a recognition by Cyrus that Yahweh is the one who anointed him, who called him, who enabled him to do these things. Verses 4, 5, 6 focus on that purpose. 'For which Cyrus is about these things.' And poetically, 4, 5, 6 are tightly woven together, structured together. For the sake of my servant Jacob and Israel my chosen. And then verse 6 begins the same way. In the RSV, in one case it's for, in the other case it's that. So translation's given. But in Hebrew, it's the same word. For the sake of, or in order that, or for the sake of my servant Jacob, for the sake of that men may know, verse 6. It's for those purposes, for Israel, that Israel may be delivered, that Israel may be saved, and for the purpose that men may know from the rising of the sun and from the west, there is none besides me, that all of humanity may know that there is none besides Yahweh. It is for these two purposes, for Israel and that larger purpose, for the nations. It's for those reasons that I call you, Cyrus, by name. I gird you, verse 5, even though at this point in time you do not know that I am doing it. I am the Lord. There is no other. I alone am capable of doing this thing. Verse 7, more creation language. I form light and create darkness. I make weal and create woe. I am the Lord who do these things. In the space of that verse, four times with three different words. You know, this, the standard creation vocabulary. That unique word bara that we talked about the other day, as well as the more graphic words of to fashion, to form, as the potter would fashion a shape out of clay. The word asa, to make, the word that's used of creation in Genesis 2. All those words associated with creation stories woven into this one verse. And the prophet, after proclaiming this word about Cyrus, that Cyrus is the anointed of Yahweh to do these things in order that not only Israel may be saved, but in order that all humanity may know that there is no God but Yahweh, the prophet can do nothing but in verse 8 to break into song. There's a hymn. At this point, at verse 9, we have to put ourselves back in the shoes of the audience. Those Jews in exile who simply couldn't comprehend what the prophet is saying. You know, how can Yahweh say such a thing? How can the prophet say such a thing? That Cyrus is the anointed of Yahweh. That Cyrus will accomplish our liberation. And so in 9 through 13, we have the prophet addressing his critics within his own community. And the argument here that the prophet uses against his critics is once again the argument from creation. Woe to him who strives with his maker, an earthen vessel with the potter. Does the clay say to him who fashions it, what are you making, for your work has no handles? Woe to him who has a father, who says to a father, what are you begetting? Or to a woman, with what are you in travail? What right do you, my critics, have to argue with the one who formed you, with the Creator? Thus says the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, and his Maker, the Maker of Israel, the Creator of Israel. Will you question me about my children, or command me concerning the work of my hands? I made the earth and created man upon it. It was my hands that stretched out the heavens, and I commanded all their host. I who have done these things, I who have created all things, who have stilled the forces of chaos, who have subdued them, I am the one who has now aroused Cyrus in righteousness. I will make the ways of Cyrus straight. Cyrus shall build my city. He shall set my exiles free. Not for price, nor for reward. And so I kind of wind up my comments. All that we've been talking about up till today, in terms of these future expectations about creation and about salvation, are now by this prophecy focused in the historical agent of Cyrus. That Cyrus is the agent of gospel for the people of Israel. And that's remarkable. That's remarkable. To be sure, there are instances in the Old Testament where foreign kings, pagan kings, are agents of Yahweh. But up till this point, they've always been agents of Yahweh's judgment. Or to put it in Lutheran terms, agents of law. Nebuchadnezzar is considered by Jeremiah in these two verses here, Jeremiah 25 and 27. Nebuchadnezzar is described as Yahweh's agent in bringing judgment upon the people of Judah because of their sin. Likewise in Isaiah 10, Assyria, described in the same terms. Assyria is the agent of Yahweh to bring judgment upon the people of Judah because of their sin. If you continue to read in chapter 10, however, it goes on to say that Assyria won't get off scot-free in this either, that Assyria will likewise be judged. But for the time being, they are agents of Yahweh's judgment. So foreign kings do serve the purposes of Yahweh, but up until this point, it is always the purpose of judgment, the purpose of law. But with Cyrus, this foreign king is the agent of gospel, of good news for the exiles. Remarkable. It's the new thing, the remarkable thing that Yahweh does, as we meet it in the words of this prophet. As we said earlier, the remarkableness, the extraordinary nature of this gospel, from our perspective, does not surprise us. But a passage such as this sort of gives new dimensions or new color to that remarkable gospel that you and I know already. So I'll stop there and be happy to... I believe he wrote them before, but not that much before. In other words, what biblical scholarship today says, the feeling we get from reading this material, reading the whole of this section, 40 through 55, is that the prophet writes these things, tries to bring this word to his contemporaries at some point after Cyrus has overtaken or overcome the Median Empire in 550 BC. So sometime during the period 550 to 540 BC. The Edict of Cyrus is 538, or Cyrus captures Babylon 539. So it's in the decade, roughly, sometime during that decade before, that Cyrus is already on the move, and those who have the eyes to see and the ears to hear have some sense of what this might mean. And the prophet is one who is keenly sensitive and sees in the stirrings of history this, you know, the act of, or the hand of Yahweh at work to bring about liberation for his people. Whether or not the average Jew or the average citizen of Babylon knew anything of Persian policy is an open question. The thing that sets the Persians apart from the Assyrians or the Babylonians is that the Persians in their empire were very benevolent rulers. The Assyrians were notorious that they'd capture a state and they would forcibly exile people. They'd take large groups of people, well, this is what happened in the northern kingdom of Israel after 721, when it was taken over by the Assyrians. They forcibly exiled people from the northern kingdom, settled them clear across the other end of the Assyrian empire, brought people from the other end of the empire, and resettled them in the northern kingdom.
Why?
As a way of breaking up clusters of power. I mean, if you come in and rule a nation and you leave it intact, I mean, you're inviting rebellion, the way to put down any potential rebellion is to mix up your population. And so you take the leadership away and you settle in someplace else, bring somebody else in their place, somebody from different culture, different language. That's the way you avoid difficulties. The Babylonians did that. The Persians did not. The Persians allowed subject peoples to pretty much mind their own affairs, conduct their own internal affairs, practice their own religion. Cyrus's edict about rebuilding the temple and subsequently providing money to help with the rebuilding was not an uncommon thing in the Persian Empire, that they did that for other subject peoples as well. They encouraged subject peoples to practice their own religion. Whether Second Isaiah, how much of, what kind of sense Second Isaiah had of kind of Persian policy, who knows?
What sense did Cyrus have of Yahweh? Any?
Probably none. The prophet's expectation is that I will do these things for you that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by name. Evidently some expectation of the prophet that Cyrus would come to know Yahweh. Whether that happened or not, we don't know. In terms of Yahweh or Cyrus giving some acknowledgement to Yahweh in the Persian scheme of things. Well, the word here is just the common word for evil in terms of moral kind of evil. I don't see it as having any, picking up any kind of mythic, it has no mythic connotations here. In terms of good and evil in the affairs of persons, the word
the
evil
Lord
is ra.
That evil? Yes.
I guess I take this to be that...
What's the word for create? Is it?
Yeah, here it's, well, it's the word, this... from the word bara, bore, the new word for creation, that all the affairs of humankind are under the dominion of Yahweh, that even evil cannot be ascribed to some sinister alien force outside of Yahweh's control, I am Yahweh and there is no other. Besides me, there are none. Even those forces that make for evil or the demonic can no longer be mythically attributed to some force in opposition to Yahweh, something like that.
Well, now, what does that have to do with Jesus being tempted in the wilderness? I mean, was there a different thought there, or different thought of Satan, or evil, or?
Well, I guess there's a preface. You know, there's a, you know, and the problem of evil. Scripture is not of one mind in terms of a kind of plurality of views and. We take this verse as we were talking about it, you know, that there is nothing outside of Yahweh's control. You know, that's one strain of thought, but then, you know, I guess we say there persists in Israel or in Jewish thought the notion that that evil temptation comes from the outside. There are alien forces set over against the power of Yahweh, so that Satan, as the accuser, get that picture in the book of Job, for example, books of Chronicles, there's a story repeated both in books of Samuel and in the books of Chronicles about David conducting a census of the people of Israel. And in the version in 2 Samuel, it's Yahweh tempts David to do this. But the version in Chronicles is that it's Satan tempts David to do this. Chronicles version is a rewriting of that history from a later perspective. And so persisting late into Judaism, you've got this development of the figure of Satan, you know, as that personifying that force that is in opposition to Yahweh, and picking up the Satan who tempts Jesus. So I guess to answer your question, there's this kind of plurality of views, and Scripture is not of one mind on that. You know, how do you deal with the problem of evil? How do you talk about the problem of evil?
You mentioned the Zoroastrians. They're of special interest to me because of their compassionate attitude towards animals. And the Parsis, of course, who left Persia. This is in contrast to the Arab invaders. My question is, what was the religion of the Zoroastrians?
I was afraid somebody's going to ask that. That's one of those things that I should know or should have spent some time with but have not. And I really can't say anything substantive about it. Can anybody else?
Isn't it tied up with light, the worship of light?
Yeah, there's a lot of dualism, you know, light, dark kind of dualism in Zoroastrianism. There are some who think that the kind of light-dark contrast or the dualism that we meet in a lot of late Jewish material or New Testament material may have come or may have been had part of its inspiration from, you know, Zoroastrian themes.
Isn't it one of the very, very ancient religions?
Here again, you know, one of those things I should know or... But don't, in terms of how far back we can trace Zoroastrian texts, I don't know.
I think Signe had a question before. She had her hand up. Signe?
Yeah. Did she have a question?
In a way, it could be that the people were so looking for a way out, and here was this great general, and they could say, well, he doesn't know it himself, but Yahweh is really using him for our good. So take heart. It just sort of could be like whistling in the dark a little bit. It seems so unusual, doesn't it, to say of this farmer that he's a Messiah and God's using him. You don't think it's sort of a wish?
Oh, I don't, you know, I guess I say I don't take it that way.
Well, I don't have any background at all.
The prophet is of the conviction that that Cyrus is doing these things, that this Cyrus will be the agent of this salvation that he fully expects to come for his people. They don't believe him. I mean, so in this passage, he has to argue with them. But the argument is premised on the basis of the prophet's conviction that Yahweh is the God who created all things, that besides him there is no God. If Yahweh alone is responsible for creation, responsible for history, all the events of history are a part of his intention, part of his purpose, that word purpose that we dealt with here. That in this military campaign of this Zoroastrian king, the hand of Yahweh is at work. And that will make for the salvation of his people.
Back to this chaos thing, it kind of falls in line with that these Assyrian kings had separated the peoples, more or less creating chaos amongst the kingdoms that they took over. And Cyrus is coming back in and saying, all right, you people don't belong over here, you belong over here. He's bringing it back to order again. He's creating some sort of order out of chaos, and therefore he's got to be a good guy.
From what we know, what I read about the Persians, that their imperial policy was humane and made sense, and as a consequence, at least in terms of the situation of the people of Israel, or the Jews during that time, life went on in a very normal kind of fashion. And we don't know all that much about what went on during the Persian period, but have little sense of discord or difficulty or rebellion or contention or that kind of internal kind of turmoil among the Jews doesn't surface until well after the Persian period, with in the 2nd century B.C., when now the Greeks rule Palestine, the Seleucid Greeks from Antioch, and who fail to appreciate the kind of policy that the Persians had, as well as the group of Greeks who also ruled Palestine during the period after Alexander, or after the Persians, after the death of Alexander, from 323 down to 198 B.C., Greeks who ruled Palestine from Alexandria in Egypt, the Ptolemies, I guess my guess is that they kind of learned the lesson from the Persians on how to treat subject peoples, and so Palestine was, the Jews were left pretty much to do their own thing during that period under Greek rule. But then Palestine changed hands in 198. The Ptolemies were defeated by the Seleucids, Greeks who ruled from Antioch. And the Seleucids didn't understand, hadn't learned that lesson at all, and began to impose upon the Jews Greek culture, Greek religion, Greek ways of doing things. And the Jews rebelled. And the so-called Maccabean revolt took place then. But Persians and Ptolemies alike, and left well enough alone. This is a picky little thing, but verse 7:45, I get struck by the, I am the Lord who do, why not who does?
I have to talk to the translator, I don't know.
To mix singular and plural like that bothers me. Is there a reason? Is there an expert on the English language in our midst? No.
Isn't it I do all these things?
All right. But ordinarily, who does?
I know, but if I do, like you say, I am the Lord, I do all of these things.
Yeah.
Impose the
could
I.
Be that that's,
I'm not an English teacher or anything.
I think does is the correct one after who, but I would,
well,
this maybe has no relationship. But you know, the Queen of England refers to herself as we. maybe the Lord thinks
that. Oh yeah, in terms of, I guess looking at this in English, as long as you've got the relative pronoun who, I guess I would say I am the Lord who does all these things. The Hebrew though could be translated simply I, Yahweh, do all these things.
That's King James.
Because in the Hebrew there's no relative pronoun. There's no verb either. It's just I, Yahweh, well, I mean, I in terms of I am. Could be said I, comma, Yahweh, comma, do all these things. Well, have a cup of coffee tomorrow, the last session on the servant of the Lord. Any of you want to come back and eavesdrop as I show these pictures to the Narnia kids, feel free to do it.